on and it didn't go live. Holy cow. I hit go live. I'm sorry, folks. You know, if you were waiting for us to go live, we have been talking now for the last 5 minutes. We did the intro.
Yeah, we're kind of tardy today.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought I had hit it solidly, and I guess I didn't. I apologize for that, guys. So anyway, I want to try to do this a low rank and Curtis. Or just go with it that you're listening to Southern Sense. Yeah,
we had our rehearsal session. let's do it again.
We were discussing this senator in Nebraska that switched from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party because the Democrats were not honoring his Catholic faith and his belief in the sanctity of life at inception through birth, where a lot you see here, they're pushing for abortion up to the time of birth. And he's saying, no, that's not my faith. I'm a Roman Catholic. This is what we believe. Mm-hmm. And the Democratic Party just did not like that. You know, you've got Joe Biden claims to be a Roman Catholic, John Kerry, Nancy Pelosi. And I'm sorry, they don't seem very adherent to their faith. So and this man, they really did. And they publicly humiliated him on numerous occasions, denouncing him. And he said, that's it. I had it with the Democratic Party. I'm going with the Republican Party, which basically changed the makeup in Nebraska. And as I was saying with Curtis before I screwed up the starting of the stream, that Senator Mike McDonnell, citing his pro-life beliefs and Catholic faith, gave his reason. He's changing the party registration as well. And it has huge implications for November because now it's a Republican majority in Nebraska's unicameral legislature, which is now filibuster-proof, clearing a path to passing legislation that would change the state to a winner-take-all electoral college system, which will be a major blow to creepy Uncle Joe. I did the rhyme again. Anyway, for those that tuned in before I screwed everything up, we had a little bit of a change in our lineup. We were supposed to have Patrick Burns with us with his great new book out there, Danger Close, Domestic Extremists Threat Number One Comes Clean. And the book is fantastic. I mean, it is a page turner. He has been called out of the country for whatever reason, and he was not able to join us. So instead, if I can get my notes here correctly, we are going to have Paul Chesser, and he is the Director of Corporate Integrity for the National Legal and Policy Center. He will be joining us. What we're going to be talking about, where we're going to go, I don't know, but we're going to wing it, and we're going to have a lot of fun if I don't screw anything else up.
Let's stay live.
Yeah. If we can manage to do that. But that said, those that do watch the show know that we start off each and every show with a dedication to a fallen hero. And I'm doing this a little bit differently today because on Monday, a gentleman passed away. He was 102 years old. He was the last surviving member of the USS Arizona. And his story is absolutely phenomenal. And as a matter of fact, I'm getting goosebumps just because I had watched a lot of the interviews and videos of him. He died on Monday. He was a 20-year-old quartermaster at the time of the naval assault and was on the back decks of the battleship on December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese forces attacked and decimated the U.S. Pacific Fleet in Pearl Harbor. And the attack killed 1,177 on the Arizona alone. And 900 of those individuals have never been recovered. And the myth goes is that when the last survivor of the USS Arizona passes away, the oil that has been bubbling up since its sinking will stop. The last bubble will come up. Whether that myth is true, I would like someone to let me know whether or not that has happened. I've heard over the years it has slowed down. But with his passing, the myth goes, the oil will stop bubbling up. So with that said, I picked up some videos. And this is Luke Hunter doing an interview. And let me bring this video up. So I will pop.
Well, the ceremony on December 7th, they asked me, I'm glad to come out and everything, and I always tell them that it's an honor to come out and pay tribute to the 2,403 servicemen that were killed that day, and including 1,177 of my shipmates on the USS Arizona. And that's mainly what I come out for, is to pay homage to those and all of the other World War II veterans that died after that. I was on a quarterdeck. I was quartermaster third class, and my job was to steer. I was a channel helmsman. My job was to steer the ship in and out of port. Out to sea, we always had other men on the helm, boatswain mates and so forth from different divisions, but coming in and out of port, I steered the ship in and out of port with the pilot and captain on board and everything. So in port, the quartermaster station is on a quarterdeck between turret 3 and mainmast. It's got an office there in the mainmast, and that's where the gangplank, the guys go on liberty and everything. We can check them, keep the log and everything. At sea, our station is a bridge where every officer of the deck is and the navigator and everything else. And so I was down there. It was 8:05. We had 8 to 12 watch on Sunday. 8:05, the planes started coming over. We knew immediately what they were, and we signed general quarters, and everybody went to their battle stations. And 100% of the Arizona band went to their battle stations, and 7 minutes later, the bow of the ship blew up and was on fire, and every one of them were killed. We lost 1,177 there in about 8 minutes of morning battle. They had a 1,600-pound armor-piercing shell that the bombers dropped from 10,000 feet. It was no doubt a lucky hit, because it's pretty tough to hit them from 10,000 feet to that spot. And they hit on the starboard side of the deck by number 2 turret, went through 5 decks into the lower handling room, which is the handling room for all the ammunition for turret 1 and turret 2. There was over 1,000,000 pounds of powder in there. And when it went in there and exploded, it exploded that 1,000,000 pounds of powder. And the valve came out about 30 to 40 feet out of the water and settled straight back down. And she's still settling right there right now. And everything was a fire forward of the mainmast. Men were coming out of the fire, on fire, burning. Wanted to jump over the side, but the oil was burning. And Commander Fuqua gave us orders to lay him down on deck, even if we had to render him unconscious until we could get him into a lifeboat and get him to the hospital. And that's what we did. And we were on the ship for about 40 minutes and then abandoned ship. And we got out, took all the people we could out of the bay and everything alive to the hospital, and came back and helped battle the fire until Tuesday. And we went to the base force and rested. It took about 5 days for it to cool down. And then we went back aboard. And a couple of guys, Pete Huzar, our main diver, he was what got off. About 20 of us went back and set up 3 air pumps with shallow water helmets. And he took his regular helmet, and he went down and stayed down for 3, 4, 5 hours. And we'd only stay down about 30 minutes looking at hatches and looking for people, and brought out a few dead bodies, only about 6 or 8. And then he called it off. It was too dangerous because we're getting air hoses caught on the edges of hatches and everything else. So he called it off. And our executive officer was Captain Geiselman. He was ashore. His family was there in Honolulu. And they made him provost marshal. Remember, that was territory Hawaii. There was no state then. And he went to Honolulu and set up his office. And he called Pete Huzar and myself in to be main people at shore patrol. And we had a little Jeep with a 30 caliber machine gun in the back. And the order went out to the people that nobody would... on the streets after sunset or before sunrise, they get shot. And the people knew we meant what we said. And there were no attorneys telling us, we can't do this, you can't do that. And we ran it the way it should have been run and the way it was run, and it was a good. And that order was in effect until May of 1945. We did our job, got it done as best we could. And thank God we won World War II.
You're watching Island News.
Well, we have some sad news to report. Lou Conter, the last survivor of the USS Arizona, died this morning. He was 102 years old.
Our Rick Kwan looks back at the life of this true American hero.
Lou Conter died peacefully, surrounded by family at his home in Grass Valley, California. When I visited last spring, he showed me the Pearl Harbor memorabilia he kept throughout his house. More than 80 years after the attack, the memories remain vivid. On December 7, 1941, 1,177 Arizona crew members died. Conter helped rescue some of the 335 who survived. A direct hit from an armor-piercing bomb doomed the ship. He was a 20-year-old quartermaster at the time.
Floated up there, and we were back here, and the guys coming out of the fire. We had to help them out of the fire and into the boat to get to the hospital. Well, we got 16 or 18 of them off the deck there.
Conter later became a pilot and flew PBY Catalina seaplanes in the Pacific. Twice he was shot down. Once he had to fight off sharks to survive.
And then first sharks that came along, I punched one of them in the nose real hard and it swam away. So the guys knew that was what to do. We had six, seven sharks around us all the time.
Following World War II, he became an intelligence officer and flew combat missions in Korea. He also created the Navy's first survival, evasion, resistance, and escape program. While he was unable to attend the most recent December 7th Pearl Harbor ceremony, he was well represented by friends and family at the event. The keynote speaker was his nephew, Marine fighter pilot Captain Ray Hauer.
To be able to represent Lou, it means a lot to me and it means a lot to my family. And I'm proud that I'm able to represent him and that people can find some similarities between us so that his legacy continue to live on.
In his book, The Lou Conter Story, he explains he wrote it in part as a tribute to his lost shipmates and that their sacrifices needed to be remembered, understood, and honored. He never saw himself as a hero, but his legacy proves otherwise. Conter will be buried next to his wife, Val, in Grass Valley, California. Rick Kwan, Island News.
Gone but never forgotten.
Let it be said, when we finished this race, we kept them free, we led with grace. Let it be seen, from sea to shining sea, beautiful America, living our legacy. Oh, Father, Mother, sister, brother, oh, we gotta learn to love each other, oh, nation for all the next generation. Let us be known as people.
Right, and we are back. That was Tiffany, Soul of a Nation. Oh, man. Wow. What a start off to the show. I didn't mess that up too badly. Not too badly. Anyway, we got a friend of ours that is up in the chat room watching on one of our stations here. And I want to give a shout out to Mike Covert, who is now going to be carrying us on BigPatriotRadio.com. Curtis and I were discussing earlier that he's a local guy, that he's a former county councilman that started his radio station about 2 years ago, and it's taking off like gangbusters. And because he's a good friend, I put up with him and he puts up with me. So as soon as we can work out my not screwing this up too much, I think Mike and I are going to have to sit down and have a drink together and get up, help me get my act together, not his, but my act. Oh, man. And like I said, we have Mark Tapscott joining us in a few moments. He should be... we're on StreamYard, if anyone wants to know the service we are now using that's going out to everywhere like Facebook and LinkedIn and YouTube and Twitch and X. Yes, we're up live on X. Still trying to get it up live on our homepage back. We'll get that done. But he should be StreamYarding in very shortly. We've had so much other stuff to talk about. And like I said, we had someone else going to come on twice, two different people, and they had to back out one after another for one reason or another. So we have, who did I say? Paul, no, Annie, get your act together. Oh, yeah, Paul Chaser, who's going to be joining us at towards the end of the show. But there's something that came across my desk as I was doing the research for today, and this is from Breitbart. Joel B. Pollack wrote this yesterday, and it's a report that the U.S. Get that teeth in straight. Here we go. UCLA required medical students to join, quote, Free Palestine, unquote, prayer to, quote, Mama Earth, unquote. You've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me. What are they doing to our medical field? They are actually decimating our medical field. We have people coming in to medicine, doctors, nurses, technicians that are being taught to be more woke than to be medically trained. And that's a scary thought. I'm sorry, you're going to now treat me based upon what? I'm not transgender. I don't follow your ideology. I'm not woke enough yet. I'm not a member of your tribe. What is your reason now? Are you going to be turning around and deciding, well, I'm messed up in the head because maybe I'm transgender, and you're going to try to convince me I am? I mean, what is with this woke ideology that they're trying to corrupt medical people? I'm sorry. If I need a heart transplant, I want the best cardiologist surgeon there. I don't care what color, creed, religion you are. If you're the best in your field, this is a meritocracy. You want the best. You got a hangnail? That's no big deal. Wait a minute. No, I did have a friend ending up with a heart attack because of an infection because of a hangnail. It's a true story.
Yeah, I would say outside of politics, the medical field, I mean, they are very woke.
Yeah, unfortunately. Ready, you know, we do have Mark with us. Let's bring Mark in. And hey, this is the face that only good enough for radio, so he says. Mark Tapscott from the Epoch Times.
How you guys? Mark.
Oh, man. It is going nuts out there. We started off the show talking about that Senator McConnell of Nebraska that just said, I'm not putting up with your woke ideology, and I'm switching to the Republican Party. And that really changed the dynamics in Nebraska, and it's going to push legislation through. So it's going to be, you take the Electoral College, you take the state. And the Democrats are crying in their coffee. Oh, I see you're so unhappy. You're crying too, Mark.
Well, you know, frankly, the thing that kind of surprises me when I first read about that is that there haven't been more state level Democrats that kind of move. And I won't be surprised if we do see some more, especially if the campaign develops, you know, in August, September, and October with Biden clearly in big trouble. You'll see more of that.
Well, you know, it's been a little bit of a mayhem in the House and the Senate lately. Marjorie Taylor Greene called for the resignation of Speaker Johnson. And the second I heard that, I go, she just stepped on it big time, yeah, big time. You've got members there that are saying, I can't handle this anymore. I'm not going to run. You even have a couple say, I'm resigning at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Thankfully, you have someone like Senator Johnson and say, no, 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 this is the, too many things are going on wrong. And Ron Johnson said, I'm not giving up the ship. Our nation is worth fighting for. You had an interview with him, didn't you?
Yeah, I talked to him at some length, and that's a very accurate description of his attitude, and it became really important back in the 2022. You'll recall he had a really close, probably the closest Senate race in the country, and he was clearly the most vulnerable Senate Republican incumbent, and yet he won, and he won with a fair margin in a state like Wisconsin. He's very conservative, and yet he's carried Wisconsin, which is traditionally somewhat of a blue state. He's carried it three times. So, you know, there's something to be said for saying, here's where I stand, this is why I stand here, and I'm not changing.
Yeah, well, what I like about your Senator McConnell out of, and no relation to Mitch McConnell, I understand, when he actually changed the whole dynamics because it's a unicameral legislature. So now it's filibuster free, so they can put through all of the Republican policies they want. So that's a big, big win for that. And Joe Biden.
Curtis, is she always emotional like this?
On occasion.
On occasion.
But, okay, whatever the House of Representatives enact, the Senate could stop. Am I correct?
That's correct. You know,
I mean, they're led by the Democrats.
Yep. You know, you mentioned Marjorie Taylor Greene and her threat to introduce a motion to vacate. Which you have to take seriously, given the way the rules are. I frankly was mystified when she announced that she was thinking about doing that. And you know, I have to say, I think Speaker Johnson has gotten some. I think he's really had some unreasonable expectations from a lot of folks on the right. A lot of folks that I probably in any other situation would probably agree with. But my gosh, he only had a 4-vote majority when he became speaker.
Yeah.
And of those 4 votes, you know, there's a dozen House Republicans whose votes you cannot depend upon from a conservative perspective. And since he became speaker, Kim Buck announced that he's leaving and then left. You've got, I think, Clay Higgins has announced that he's out. Of course, Santos got kicked out, justifiably so, in my view. Mm-hmm. So you've got a 1-vote majority to get anything done. So if ever there is a time when you need a speaker who can, you know, for better or worse, can draw votes from both sides, now's it. If the Republicans had a 25-vote majority in the House and the Speaker was doing some of the things that Mike Johnson has had to do, you know, we'd probably think differently about it. But I don't see any alternative. I think he's been as good as he could be under the circumstances.
Well, I hope someone just pulled her aside and said, you know, this is not a brilliant move at this moment. Matter of fact, it would hurt Republicans more than anything. I mean, she's doing the blistering threat, you know, let's get more like Freedom Caucus. I can understand that, but it's the wrong time to do it when so much is on balance, imbalance. I mean, we need even a rhino to be convinced you're better off siding with us and Speaker Johnson than siding with the Democrats, even trying to pull independents over onto our side, saying, listen, our country is in a mess. Your Speaker Johnson can unite us, even though we have to make compromises. There are times you must make compromise. You put that compromise through, you get your foot in the door, and then you work on opening the door down the road.
Yeah.
But let's just get our damn foot in the door And I think maybe someone pulled her into the woodshed and beat a little sense into her.
Well, you know,
I'm probably going to be like censored now.
Before I became a journalist, I was a Reagan political appointee for 5 years. And I'm very proud of that fact because I think President Reagan was probably the best president this country has had since Lincoln. But one of the things that President Reagan was known for was he said, my 80% friend is not thereby my 20% enemy. And, you know, that used to be a pretty common attitude in both parties. It's not today.
No.
And there's folks in both parties that, you know, they're going to go down raising the flag, but they're going to go down because they're not willing to accept a compromise. And, you know, our government requires, for it to function effectively, everybody has got to give a little bit. And that's not happening these days.
No, it's not. If I remember correctly, Reagan had the kitchen diplomacy with Tip O'Neill.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well, they were both Irishmen. They both liked a little.
They liked to tipple. Tip and tipple. Pun intended. And I remember that because in the 80s when I joined NYPD, one of my sergeants, his last name was O'Neill. And really? he was like, you never knew where he stood, but he always found a way to compromise. And that was during the kitchen diplomacy going on. So he got the nickname of Tip O'Neill.
I actually had occasion to talk with Tip O'Neill one time, not long at all. I was a very young man. And I have to say, he was very...
You were never young.
Well, much younger than I am now. But he was a very approachable guy. And he and Reagan, you know, they would get together in the evening, tell each other jokes, and relive the old days for them. And they got things done.
Mm-hmm. Which is missing in today's government. You're on either one side of the aisle or the other. Yeah. And to find a way to make compromise, to get what we need to get done. Look at the mess we have on the border. I mean, in a way, Congress can act. But if they can't get their act together, if you the House is saying, all right, we got H.R. 2, let's build on that. And then the Senate comes out with this massive cluster, you know what?
Yeah.
That's not a compromise. That's just absolutely stopping on the other.
It's not. And you know, the guy who on the Republican side who was most identified with that, Senator Lankford from my home state of Oklahoma, one of my home states, Texas being the other one. You know, the Democrats portrayed that, they still do. President Biden portrays it as a genuine compromise that would have fixed the border problem. In fact, it would have made the border problem permanent. It would have legalized a continuous stream of people coming into the country like we've never had before until President Biden came into office. That's not a compromise.
No, it's not. And you know how bad it was? It was so bad that John Fetterman, that whack job, turned around and says, HR 2 is better than what you're putting out here. When you've got the most oddball in the Senate.
I want to know what he's smoking.
Me too. I want some of that. Must be really good stuff.
Now, isn't it true that anything the Republicans would have came up with in the House and it went to the Senate, wouldn't they have gone against it if it would have ended the problems we had at the southern border? And wouldn't Biden have vetoed it?
Well, Biden,
because they don't want a solution.
Yeah, but you see, Curtis, you point to the very heart of the problem here. The House passed H.R. 2. And
I remember.
You may not agree with it, but it was a reasonable, logical approach to the problem. They sent it over to the Senate. It hasn't even gotten a committee hearing.
They don't want it.
They're not looking at it at all. That's not the way to address a major problem. You know, you can't just ignore it.
And anyway, Biden himself could solve the problem.
Of course, but that's not going to happen.
You know, one of the other things I want to talk to you about is what is going on with the Senate with the Mayorkas impeachment. Is Schumer going to can it, or has it gotten to the point where he's not going to have much of a choice and he must go forward somehow?
Yeah, I literally just got off the phone from a long conversation with some folks in the Senate, and every expectation is that the House managers will come over to the Senate probably Wednesday afternoon, later in the afternoon. They'll present it formally. The actual articles of impeachment that the House passed will have to be read to the Senate, and then all of the senators are sworn in as jurors, and you should have a trial that then begins. The rules, the Senate rules on how they do impeachment trials, which were pretty rare prior to the last 8 years, the rules are very specific. And what they say is at 1 o'clock the day after the House presents the impeachment articles to the Senate has to convene in a trial. Well, every expectation that I hear from folks in the Senate now is that Schumer will very likely allow that trial to convene, but then there will be immediate motions, privileged motions, to table both of the counts, both of the articles that the House adopted to impeach Mayorkas. And that'll be the end of it. There won't be any discussion about the actual evidence, and off they'll go. So we'll see. I will be surprised if it happens, if it plays out any differently than that.
Kind of like, it sounds to me like during the Bill Clinton, when they were going after him, the impeachment, and they went to the Senate. Trent Lott said, don't bring this to us. We don't want this. And nothing happened in the Senate.
Yeah. And let's see now, Trent Lott was he a Democrat? No, he wasn't. He was a Republican.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And they had a pretty solid majority.
That's right. They didn't want to touch it.
Yep. Well, Schumer clearly doesn't want to touch it. If you look at this from the perspective of, he's got a number of incumbents, Democrats in the Senate, who are pretty vulnerable. Sherrod Brown in Ohio being one of them, another one being John Tester in Montana. And there's a number of other seats that could very easily become competitive. The last thing they want is to have on national television
impeachment.
The discussion of why the House impeached Mayorkas. Because all Mayorkas did was what Joe Biden said do.
Wow. Now, talking about the Biden crime family, Hunter is not escaping those tax charges, is he?
Apparently not. We'll see where that goes. I suspect that he is hoping that can be resolved one way or the other before January 20th of 2025. Because there may well be a president in office who will not pardon him, you know?
You think maybe he'll turn around and negotiate for some sort of a plea deal, so something like that?
Yep.
And Daddy or someone else, maybe Halliburton or someone will bail him out?
I think there will be a list of midnight pardons that Biden does his last night in the White House. And on the top of that list will be Hunter Biden. And probably the next name will be James Biden.
Now, I got this from a very confidential source. Someone who is very close to someone in the Secret Service on the detail. And they're saying what they see in the public eye of Joe Biden is completely different than behind. Are you hearing the same things?
Well, you know, former President Trump, I think yesterday, said something about if we have a debate, I think Biden should submit to a drug test.
Wow.
No, I mean, you see the man. I feel sorry for him. I mean, really, he has such difficulty with the simplest things. And then we see him at the State of the Union. You know, he is. That's a different guy.
Yeah.
You know, people have a right to know how exactly are they doing that.
Mm-hmm. And who was
sure,
actually
sure
making...
didn't work on Easter.
No, it didn't.
But actually, that question is who is actually running the country? Who is the acting president at this point? And you know, it's not Queen Kamala Mella when she can't even figure out March Madness.
Well, many times he has said they won't let me do this or that, and everybody's wondering who's they.
Yeah,
he's the president.
Well, but I suspect that Jeffrey Zients, who is the White House chief of staff, you know, this is not the first time America, has had a president who was physically incapacitated.
Woodrow Wilson was.
His wife ran the country for a year, a little more than a year, I think.
Right. Yeah, the secret president.
Yeah.
Then there was also Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yes.
So, you know, yeah. So we can probably say Jill Biden is probably behind a lot of what's going on then.
Well, might be interesting to see how often she and Jeffrey Zients talk.
Any White House logs on that one? I doubt it. It's probably the same log is the same place that the cocaine was found in. Well, what should we be looking out for in the news in the upcoming week?
Well, on Monday and Tuesday this coming week, this is one of the things we were just talking about in the Senate. There will be efforts by some of the Senate Republican conservatives to make the case for having a for following the rules and having a trial on Mayorkas. I don't expect that's going to get anywhere, but they will make the case, and there will be some coverage of it anyway. The other issue that I have a feeling is going to get pretty important, pretty prominent in the next couple of weeks is reauthorizing the FISA court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance. That is a big, big deal because there are so many connections to issues like the Trump Russiagate stuff. The illegal FISA warrants that the FBI used in that. And you have this increasing federal government, the Department of Justice, the FBI, and Department of Homeland Security, surveilling Americans and, you know, monitoring what we say on social media. And there are a lot of people in Congress in both parties. Senator Ron Wyden is somebody to watch. He's an Oregon Democrat, and he is very much a civil libertarian, and I will be surprised if he is not very vocal about it in the days ahead. So keep an eye on that.
Be interesting. It should be very, very interesting. You mentioned, you know, the Trump trials. There was something just new and breaking about Fannie Willis recording a conversation of a defendant's attorney. I don't know if you caught that.
I heard just a little bit about it. And if, in fact, what she did was record something from a defendant, that's I'm not a lawyer, but even I know you can't do that. That's blown.
Unethical.
Yeah,
But it destroys lawyer-client privilege.
Well, she ended up recording a conversation with a lawyer in Maryland. She's in Georgia.
Can't do that. Mm-mm.
Maryland has, you must have both parties' consent.
Right.
Otherwise, it's a felony.
That's
now,
right.
This is how good an attorney she is, because Georgia is only one consent. Now, you're talking to an attorney about their client, and he's not consenting to be recorded from a state. He's actually physically in that state where the law is. So, in other words, the law applies to the state of the victim.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
Well, yeah, it's more like Looney Tune. This woman is just gotten so out of hand. It's unbelievable.
And head over class, I guess.
I mean, I don't even know how she is still practicing law with everything that's coming to light. But if she gets convicted of these felonies, well, there goes your law license. You're going to be disbarred.
Yeah. Well, you know, with Fannie Willis and Joe Biden and George Santos, you know, with every elected politician, we always have to remember we elected them.
We elected
them. Well, Mark, refresh my memory, but isn't everyone that was involved in the Whitewater little scandal, they were disbarred? People like Obama and Michelle and Hillary, maybe Bubba.
I don't remember enough to say on that. Boy, Whitewater, that goes back.
That it does. That it does. You know, there's so much more to talk about. I know that you always have limited time.
I'm over my limit at the moment.
But the last thing I want to mention is that some of these cases with Trump are starting to fall to the wayside. But the latest news is now Trump is countersuing E. Jean Carroll over that $83 million judgment. And he's basing it upon the fact that the judge, when he made that judgment in a civil case, he stated that Trump was a rapist, that he raped her. Yeah. And Trump has never been tried or convicted of that crime. So that's a very possibility that that judgment will be tossed out the window. And Trump's attorney saying, well, we're not only going to get the judgment overturned, we're going after court costs.
Well, you know, and I wouldn't be surprised. I'm losing my voice today. I've been talking too much. I would not be surprised if Trump succeeds in that effort, that we would then also see something in the way of a move to disbar that judge. Because that was surprising, to say the least.
Absolutely. Well, and Mark, I know that you do have to run. You are the DC, the correspondent for the Epoch Times. You're a chief Coke and bottle washer over there, and people can always find that fantastic magazine over online, and I get it home delivered. Good. I also do the Sudoku. Well, God bless you. We'll see you again in 2 weeks, Mark.
Y'all too. Curtis, take care.
All right. Have a great weekend.
Take care.
Mark Tapscott, check him out at theepochtimes.com. Oh, man. I'm looking for something I had here I wanted to talk to you about. But, oh, I know what it is. It's a clip I want to play for you and for the audience. And I don't know if people realize that since COVID, there have been these squatter rights.
That's been in the news big time.
Yeah, and people have actually been arrested for attempting to get squatters out of their homes, out of properties they own. I don't understand how you consider this a civil matter. You have someone who broke into a property, have been abusing it. They've entered illegally, which is then trespassing. They are, in some cases, selling the property of the homeowners. That's theft. There are several different criminal charges I can think of. But when the police show up on the scene, they're told, well, this is a civil matter. And if the homeowner proceeds, the homeowner has a good chance of being arrested. Now, there was this handyman whose mom had her home invaded by squatters. And this guy's name... I just had it over here somewhere. Oh, bear with me, please. I have notes scattered all over the place. Hang on a second, Annie. His first name is Flash. And I think Flash Shelton. And he is the owner of United Handyman Association. And this was a clip that was from Fox News last night. Let me play this up here.
So I'm fascinated by squatting, not the position, the real estate move. The vagrant sees an empty home, breaks in, makes it their own. They live in your house and you pay the bills there. They have rights to do this. They call them squatters' rights. And don't call the cops because they won't help. That's what happened to our friend Darthula in Chicago.
No, they can't do anything about it. When I first went over there and you could see the window was broken, they broke in, they changed the locks. My mother's furniture and her personal belongings are still on the property. When I asked them to remove him for breaking and entering, he told us that he's a professional squatter and he knows his rights.
So if you can't do anything and a judge takes forever to hear your case, sometimes you need to take matters into your own hands. And that's what this handyman did, Flash Shelton. Flash's mom's home was vacant, so a squatter moved in. She brought in all of her stuff, so Flash found out and he staked the house out. Got there real early in the morning, waited until the squatter left, then he swooped in, put some cameras up, and when the squatter came back, he confronted her. Watch.
I haven't been able to do anything with this house for months because every time they come over here, they tell me that there's people here and that there's furniture in the house. So.
And who's telling you that?
The realtors.
That there's people here.
Yeah. So neighbors tell me that they see people coming in and the lights on. Someone went in and turned on the power because their power was off to the house. Some other people, like young and old, and some a mixture between female and males, coming into the house at night and the lights are on at night.
Well, that would not be us.
Neighbors there, neighbors there, neighbors there, and neighbors there.
That would never be us.
And those are the ones that have been calling me, telling.
So Flash gave the squatter an ultimatum. If she didn't move out her stuff, he would.
It all has to be out before I leave. I've got guys scheduled to come take the stuff out later today. So either you take it out or I have to take it out and put it out on the driveway until it gets picked up.
This is how it's done, people. Founder of the United Handyman Association, Flash Shelton, joins me now. Flash, that was a smooth move. She lied to your face, though. Did she at least admit maybe she was caught cold?
First of all, Jesse, I just want to say thank you for having me on. And, you know, she did apologize on the video.
Good.
And she tried to say that it wasn't her, that they weren't in the house, but that her furniture was accidentally delivered.
Accidentally delivered, yeah, to the wrong house. And then she just happened to sitting on the furniture that was accidentally delivered to a house that wasn't hers.
And she just happened to be pulling out of the driveway in the morning when I was scoping out the house.
All right, so this is a great maneuver that you pulled, and it gives hope to all people that have a squatter situation. What if the person had never left the house and you just stayed there staked out all day? What's the next move?
Well, I mean, I you know, obviously I didn't know, like, who was in the house at the time. So I probably would have, you know, just kind of staked out the house to see what type of individuals were going in and then make a determination if I needed to just enter the house anyway. I knew that the back door was broken in. Preemptively, I wrote up a lease and had my mom basically make me the legal tenant, got it notarized. I had current utility bills with me in my name. I had keys to the house. And at that point, I would have entered the house. And if the squatter can take a home, I can take a home. If I enter the house, they can't kick me out just as much. But with having a lease and keys and utility bills, at that point, you know, if they call the police would tell them the same thing. If I call the police, I can say, hey, I have an intruder in my house and they broke in the back door.
Boom.
Given them that information, they chose to take the safe way out, the easy way out, and move all their stuff out.
You are so smart. You had it all covered. Nothing gets by Flash. Is that your real name or is that a nickname?
Flash, you know, since I was a little kid, so it's the only name I've gone by.
I love it. Flash, thank you so much. You give us all hope. And
thanks. I just want to, yeah, go ahead.
No, please finish.
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, I appreciate all the love and support that I'm getting, but I just hope that, you know, that the outdated squatter laws get some attention too, so that maybe I can help change them.
All right. Well, maybe Lindsey Graham can rewrite some of those laws for us. I know he's going to be a little busy, but he's on a roll. Thank you very much, Flash.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade.
All right. That was up on Fox News last night. I loved it. And you know what? Because this guy started a business, because he was able to help his mom, he now has helped over 200,000 people across the United States to reclaim their homes.
And this happened in South Carolina? I heard Lindsey Graham's name.
Well, I honestly don't know if it was here in South Carolina or not. They never mentioned the state, but if you said Lindsey Graham, it probably is. But yeah, they do need to change these laws, or at least arm law enforcement with the proper tools. I'm sorry, if I showed up on a scene and there was a squatter inside the building, my first instinct would be like, all right, I'm going to have to radio the sergeant. Listen, we got someone trespassing. It seems that they've criminally destroyed the property. We've got them on two charges for that. If we find out that they stole some of the property or sold it, and we've got another charge on that. And I would be racking them up, going into the ADA with a whole list of charges on the booking sheet. But obviously, law enforcement is not being given those powers anymore. I don't know what new laws are in place that give these squatters the right to commit these crimes. And then to force the homeowners to be arrested.
Imagine if they took over the White House.
Oh. Oh, yeah. You mean like the Biden family?
We running things now.
Well, we're waiting for our guest to get himself set up. So as soon as he is, we will bring him on alive. So we're going to give him a few seconds to catch his breath. And we've got a huge thumbs up. Let's bring on to the show Paul Chesser. He is with, and let me make sure. There we go. He puts it up on the screen for me, the National and Legal Policy Center. Good afternoon, Paul. How are you today? Hey, and thank you for stopping in last minute with us. So we were
good to be with you.
This was one of those shows where we had a last minute change three times about half an hour before the show started.
Mm-hmm. So I'm the consolation prize?
Well, three strikes, you're either out or you're the winner. You're a home run.
Or I'm in, huh?
Pinch hitter.
But I see that some of the things you work on is with climate change. Matter of fact, a good friend of mine is Gregory Wrightstone, who founded the CO2 Coalition. Mm-hmm. And
acquainted with Greg.
Oh, he's a sweetheart. He's mm-hmm. If you ever mention my name to Greg, he will tell you I was his first. Actually, the very first person to ever interview him when he wrote his book.
Well, good for you. He does good work.
Yes, he does. I even had him down here to South Carolina to our Tea Party Coalition Tea Party meeting. And I also had him to our county GOP meeting just to help him hawk his book. So like I said, I'm last second, everyone shifted things around. So tell us something about what you do over there at the center.
Okay. Well, I'm the director of the Corporate Integrity Project for our organization. We are, one of the things we do, we basically are a government integrity, government watchdog on one side of things. And then the other side is the component that I manage. We do shareholder activism. So we own shares in a number of major corporations. And, we've been doing it for more than a couple decades now. Our chairman used to handle it pretty exclusively, but because he's, trying to raise money for the organization and run the organization, he would only do a couple of shareholder proposals a year. So he brought me on full time about 3 years ago. This is our third full proxy season, as they call it. The spring is called proxy season because that's when the majority of companies hold their annual meetings. And, we've done a couple dozen shareholder proposals at major companies that you would have heard of. That Disney was our meeting this week. Apple, Starbucks, McDonald's, Walmart, you name it. We've got most of them. And what we do is we're trying to, through our project, to recalibrate corporate America away from wokeism. We have an ally, National Center for Public Policy Research. We're basically the two major organizations that leans right that is involved in this. The rest of them, it's dominated by the left, and it has been for a long time now, which is why you've seen the leftward shift in corporate policy and emphasis. So our approach with our friends is, get back to neutral. A corporation shouldn't be involved in divisive political issues that divide the country, whether it's LGBT activism, climate change. We're seeing with the debate over energy affordability and so forth. There's so many components to that. With Disney this week, our proposal had to do with discrimination in compensation and pay. And it was basically modeled after a shareholder proposal that the left has brought many, many times over and over. And it theirs would have to do with fair compensation for women versus men, equality in pay for minorities versus, Asians and white people. They're always going after the discrimination angle. So because corporate America has embraced the whole gender ideology paradigm and they embrace the whole human rights campaign agenda that you can switch from being a biological woman to a man and vice versa, and they incorporated into their healthcare policies. We said, well, some of these people, they start to try to transition their gender, and then they realize that what they've done great damage to their bodies, and then they have no recourse. So we say, we take their own EEOC discrimination language and say, you're discriminating against these people who want to detransition and go back to their original God-given bodily condition, but they have no recourse. So therefore, you're discriminating. So we're basically using their own discrimination language against them. And it's kind of hoisting them up by their own petard. So that's what we've got. This is sort of an experimental proposal, and we'd say it went pretty smashingly this week. I don't know if you know of Chloe Cole.
Chloe Cole, yes.
Yeah. So she presented our proposal for us this week. We're so grateful that she did that for us. She did a very effective job. She recorded her remarks on, and they're uploaded on Twitter, and it's gone viral. So we couldn't have hoped for a better outcome. And basically, she's speaking directly to Bob Iger and the board of directors at Disney and putting them on the spot on this. So it went very well. And we'll have the same proposal coming up at Johnson & Johnson in a couple weeks, and also at Pepsi on May 1st. So again, it was an experiment. We're happy with the experiment, so we'll look forward to next year probably introducing it a few more companies.
Well, that's awesome, because I worked for American Express back in the early 80s, and I noticed back then wokeism. We didn't call it that yet. I'm sorry. I was born with a conservative gene in my body. There's not a single liberal gene. So, when they came at you at a certain time of the year, it's like, all right, fine. You want to take a certain amount of your paycheck and donate it to these certain charities. And you looked at the list of it, and out of maybe 20 or 30 list companies there, or charities or whatever it was, you'd only find one or two that had a conservative or Christian bent to it that was worth, to me, donating money to. I'm sorry. For a tree hugging thing, I'm not going to be donating. But if you're going to help to support Christians being terrorized by Muslim activists and communism, I'm all in for it. I'm not that type of a person. But when I see where we have gotten so woke that you have to turn around and say, well, I need medical care because XYZ is wrong. The doctor and I know it's between the doctor and I. But now you've got the insurance company that steps in. You got the company that purchased the policy stepping in and saying, no, that's not how we see things socially. You must conform to what we say and do. And I have a big problem with that. We're no longer a meritocracy. We're now based upon what tribe you belong to. And if you're not belonging to the correct tribe, you're going to be discriminated against. But how dare you say I'm discriminated? Mm-hmm. Because you're the wrong color skin or the wrong gender.
Right. Well, we did this, this project. Chloe is the patient advocate for a group called Do No Harm. And they're basically pushing back on the medical community, the big medical associations, the hospitals that have advocated these treatments and surgeries that are unproven and there's really no medical, serious medical research that's been done on this. They've just basically, it's the pharmaceutical companies that are, they're pushing their
big bucks, multi-billion dollar industry.
And so it's all been pushing in this one direction. And with the agenda of the human rights campaign that, the pro LGBT, they have, they've really applied the pressure and done so successfully with corporate America, to the point where every major company trumpets their 100% score on the human rights campaign corporate equality index. So now they're getting the blowback. They're reaping the blowback as a result of this, because so many people who have, you know, basically a lot of these people, they're very young. They're going through, you know, they're pre-adult. Chloe Cole is pre-adult. They have this body image issue, or, you know, they're questioning things. You know, how it is. You're awkward. You're growing into your body. You're having doubts. Your peers are, you know, and it's even intensified now with social media, and that the peer pressure applied that way. That, you know, they're just, you know, it's a serious sin that a medical practitioner or a psychological counselor says, well, you know, there is something to how you're feeling, and, you know, maybe you should just take these puberty blockers. And as Chloe ended up having, she was advised to have a double mastectomy at age 15 or 16. And now she's like, her, you know, she said in her testimony to Disney, my chest is still bandaged. She, you know, she'll be undergoing treatments and dealing with this the rest of her life. So she's very passionate about pushing back on this. And what I found very revealing, I was going through the social media posts today of her video. It's, you know, just been posted and reposted and reposted all over the place, Instagram, Twitter, or X now. It is that a girl, Chloe, way to go, Chloe. You know, in the, you know, maybe 2-3 years ago, you would have seen the pro-trans, pro-LGBT would have been, they call it ratioing, you know, she would have been just like pushed into a corner and ridiculed and vilified. There's hardly any of that now. It's all supportive. It's all really encouraging to her, both on Instagram, where that's where all the young people are.
Right.
You know, and then of course X, you know, where a lot of our allies would be, but also, you know, it represents a wide spectrum. We're on the offense now, and we're just really, I mean, it's the way this has turned out today was just told us, you know, loudly and clearly that we're on the offense. We, you know, with what's happened with Governor DeSantis and the public, the child protection laws that they enacted in Florida, Disney dropping their lawsuit over the whole special district down in Florida, you know, they're backing down, and that we were able to, you know, have Chloe speak on our behalf at the Disney meeting is just, you know, there's so many signs pointing in that direction, and we're very, very encouraged by that.
Is it just the social pushback, or are they seeing now real harm to the corporation in drops in shares, in people selling off? Are they seeing that harm, or even in people not even coming to the parks anymore?
Could be all three.
Well, I mean, there's a whole history with Disney for the last few years. You know, I don't know how much you've followed it, but, you know, Disney had a board challenge, actually from a couple of different fund advisors or fund holding companies. They wanted seats on the board to replace a couple of existing directors because of Disney's poor performance the last few years. First of all, their stock was halved. You know, basically they were up over $200 per share just within 2.5 years ago. And it's half of that right now, maybe a little more than half. It's recovered a little bit since last year, but it would drop from like 220 down to, you know, below $80 there for a while there last year. That's just the stock price. But we've seen just with the woke theatrical releases, the poor performance of, you know, the stuff where they've tried to infuse LGBT scenarios and characters and so forth, like in Strange World and in Lightyear. I mean, how do you mess up the Toy Story franchise by putting this garbage in there? And Lightyear was a huge flop. I mean, you have to try very hard to mess up the Toy Story franchise in Pixar. Pixar was such, you know, I know for our family, we have four kids, they're all grown now, but every year we would just look forward eagerly to the next Pixar release, because you could count on it to be family friendly, mm-hmm. excellent entertainment, well done, just really resonating with your emotions and everything. And that's just not the case anymore. And all these, these franchises that Disney is now the steward of are flopping and they're turning to crap. Star Wars, you know, is down. Indiana Jones released last year did terrible. It flopped. Pixar, Marvel, the last few Marvel movies with the exception of Guardians of the Galaxy. So people are not going to these theatrical releases. They're rejecting Disney in that respect. Their streaming service is not performing the way they had hoped. Disney has so many valuable properties. They have so many iconic brands, you know, besides the obvious Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, and all those characters. You got all these other ones I just mentioned. And you know, under Bob Iger and this board, it's really just malpractice. And it's got a lot to do with all this woke politics, this embrace of, things like transgenderism and just infusing children's programming. You've got a drag queen hosting a child's program on Disney Plus. I mean, come on, what are you thinking? I mean, yeah. It tells you how insulated and insular their circles are out here on these, you know, these coastal, you know, who they're hanging around with in L.A. and New York City, you know, that they're just totally insulated to their core audience, their passionate audience that is in middle America.
Look at the Oscar attendance. How many people actually tuned into the Oscars?
I think overall that the transgender agenda is suffering major backlashes. I mean, especially in the sports world. Look at the women's sports arena. There's guys and they're competing with women and they're winning. And this is hurting the females who worked all their lives to become, you know, legitimate, you know, winners.
You know, I grew up as Title IX was being fought. So as it came through, I was starting to enter into high school. And I'm thinking, great, when I come out of high school, there's so many possibilities for me now because of Title IX. And we were cheering it. You know, we never got enough equipment and there was never enough financing to women's sports in schools because they never thought that we would amount to anything out in the professional world. Well, lo and behold, yes, we did. And we had our own divisions where we were able to compete. But I'm sorry, if you tell me a man transitioning to a woman, I'm going to still say his, you know, you do a DNA test, it's still a he. That physiology, you know, what the good Lord gave him, he's got different strengths in different areas than we do. And we've already seen in certain, what were they called? Were they multiple arts, the martial arts? Several women have already had their skulls split, you know, brain damage. You've seen women suffering other areas of major injuries when competing with biological men transitioning into a woman. I'm sorry, how little testosterone.
Testosterone.
Thank you. That is left in the body doesn't alter how that person had grown and developed their muscles. A woman doesn't have that. You do. I'm sorry. It's an unequal field. I think people are starting to realize that. And Disney is finding themselves being hit in the pocketbook. There's also a lot of states are now saying, we're going to cut out DEI in education. We're going to turn around and if you're going to be investing in state pensions, we're not using ESGs. We're going to be protecting the money that you're giving us to invest. And we've seen that bank failure in California where you had someone saying, no, you have to invest in ESGs. I think the corporate world's starting to wake up, but you've got still a kickback. This is an article that was in the Republic Sentinel just yesterday about this woke advertising group called GARM. Have you ever heard of them? G-A-R-M. They were launched 5 years ago by the World Federation of Advertisers. And basically, they're the woke police for advertising. So they're basically telling you, if you don't carry our corporations like Disney that are so woke, you're going to get very low on the listing and you're not going to get the hits you want. It's getting out of hand.
So they're pro-woke. They're pro-woke, right?
Yeah.
They're for this. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think we're seeing a shift, obviously. I mean, we just had the Securities and Exchange Commission implement their climate rule. This has been, we've been waiting for this rule to come out almost a year now. And they were wanting to, you know, to force companies to disclose emissions to a far greater degree than their rule ended up being, because they got significant blowback as they were preparing this rule. So that's one indicator. The other one is that Larry Fink, the chairman and CEO of BlackRock, who's suffered a lot of blowback with a lot of red state treasurers and financial officers saying, we're disinvesting in BlackRock because you're too deep into the ESG investing. He's saying, I'm not using the term ESG anymore, and we believe in fossil fuels. And he's gone groveling to states like Texas and asking for them to not withdraw their funds, their pension funds and so forth there. He's really been working hard to salvage all that for BlackRock. And other companies are just become much more muted about their ESG advocacy. You know, Larry, it was only 2-3 years ago, Larry Fink, you know, he's famous for issuing an annual letter at the beginning of every calendar year. And he was saying, you know, if these companies, if you don't disclose these emissions and so forth, you know, we're not going to vote for the directors you want and all these things. He was really playing a thug kind of role with these various companies. And, you know, BlackRock owns 6-8% of pretty much every major company that you've ever heard of. That's how powerful BlackRock is. And State Street and Vanguard aren't far behind. Usually sometimes they own a little more than BlackRock does. And obviously it's not their money. They're just stewards of it for, you know, people who are invested in their funds. But Larry Fink was acting like it was his money, and he was pressuring all these companies to, you know, you gotta do this, you gotta do that, you gotta have, you know, at least, you know, things like you got to have at least one director, you got to have this DEI program, blah, blah, blah. He's backed way off of that. He's hardly mentioning it now in his last couple of annual letters to corporate leaders. So the tide has turned. We're not under, you know, the post George Floyd, the post, you know, the post-election climate change, you know, aggressive, you know, Green New Deal approach. You know, we're far off that because people are, you know, obviously Trump is leading in the polls against Biden because they're seeing the consequences of all those ridiculous policies and in, both in government and in corporate America. So I think, you know, now that people are seeing the outcomes, it obviously people didn't think things through. Okay, what are you going to do if we embrace letting men participate in women's sports? You know, think it through. And, you know, it's really been a consequence, I think, of the dumbing down of education. You know, all the corporate, if we engage with these major corporations at the investor relations level with, you know, some, you know, not the top executives, but, you know, the next level executives wanting to find out more about our proposal. They're products of these business schools that have been just, you know, it's academia as we know it. You know, it's infected with this ideology. And that's the manifestation of what's been produced by these business schools, is it's now populating these executive suites in these boardrooms. We have a lot to we have a lot to recover from here as a consequence.
No resting on our laurels.
Yeah, right. I've got another radio interview in about 5 minutes here.
I'm not going to hold you up, but I was just looking for something on my cell phone because I'm thinking while we're talking about Dylan Mulvaney and the Bud Light debacle. Matter of fact, I saw a friend of mine drinking it, and I kind of like gave him a dirty look because I like the taste. I'm trying to remember the name of the company. And as a matter of fact, I should remember it because I bought stock in it. American Arms Brewery or something like that, based out of Virginia. It's a bunch of military, active, retired, and law enforcement that started their own company in contrast to that. And they're taking off like crazy. There's Donald Trump has his recent merger. And yes, I have stock in that also. And it's doing just fine. We're seeing the backlash.
when you have alternatives, you know, it's not good business to be, you know, embracing these anti-American, anti-biology, anti-science positions. You know, the whole deal, you know, we could do a whole another half hour on Dylan Mulvaney.
Not
my wife and I, you know, we've seen it, and I'm sure you've seen it anecdotally on like YouTube and so forth. We went to a concert last year, a country music concert that should have been, and it was sponsored. Everything, all the booths were Bud Light this, Bud Light that. Nobody wanted Bud Light at this concert. All the booths were just, you know, everybody wanted, you know, some other, you know, wine cooler or whatever, or seltzer. They did, you know, they just had their cases full of Bud Light. So what I had seen, you know, anecdotally on YouTube, I saw with my own eyes that there's just been this widespread rejection of what Bud Light did. And I think that's just permanent damage, at least in America.
Well, Paul, it has been a lot of fun having you with us. Great sport for coming in last second. Like I said, you were the switch up hitter. But you're great. And I'm telling everyone to go check out the website that you are, the National Legal and Policy Center, which is NLPC.org.
Right. Yep. And all our, you know, we've got like four posts up there right on the homepage about what's happened with Disney this week. I really encourage you all to go watch Chloe Cole's presentation there. She did a fantastic job. We're very proud of her.
Well, God bless you for the hard work you guys do. And we hope to have you on soon again.
Great. Love it. Thank you.
Take care. All right. Paul Chaser, check out at NLRP.org. I'm getting that wrong. I'm so sorry.
I'm not even going to attempt it.
But we're down to our last few minutes here. I want to thank everyone that participated here. I still see people coming up in comments in the chat rooms and stuff. I want to thank everyone. You can participate in the chat rooms over on YouTube, Facebook, Twitch, LinkedIn, and X. So check us out over there. We'll hopefully have our webpage up and running fully again, and we'll have the chat in there also. You can also find the audio podcast in about 20 different places, including on Amazon, iTunes, and everything else. So just do a little web search and we'll pop up everywhere else. But I think that's just about all we got here for today, Curtis.
And it was great, considering all the changes, last minute changes. And not going live at first.
You know? Oh, no. That's my fault. That is my fault. We got two great guests coming up next week. And for the life of me, I can't think of their names. But I will be posting them up soon. I mean, we're getting guest booking left and right. And as it was today, we had one cancel out about an hour before the show, got a backup, and he canceled out half an hour of the show. And this guy, Paul Chaser, just popped in the last few minutes. I mean, just maybe 10 or 15 minutes before going on air, I get the message that I'm printing out as much as I can. And we did pretty good doing, you know, ad-libbing. Yeah. Well, with that said, I want to thank everyone for joining us. And we will be back, same bat time, same bat station. So we'll see you again next week. So until then, I say good night and God bless. All right.
Take care.
I'm praying for this land I love, America, America, the home of the free. But there are people making plans to change America. They've no respect for her or what matters most to me. That's why I stand for the flag and I kneel at the cross, mourn for the friends I have loved and lost. And I still believe in God we trust and the freedom of our fathers granted us. I hope it's not America. out that crime across America. We've got to rescue her. You know it's up to me and you to see the truth behind their lies. Don't change America. God bless America and the red, white, and blue. That's why I stand for the flag and I kneel at the cross. Long for the friends I have loved and lost. And I still believe in God we chose and the freedom I fought. America. Save America.